Hey, listeners, before we get to this episode of Problem Solvers, here is a word from our sponsor.
What's next? What if? Are we ready? Now what? These are questions that can keep founders up at night, and no one understands this quite like Silicon Valley Bank. For over 35 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of high-growth companies by providing scalable financial solutions along with insights and expertise that many other banks just can't. From healthcare to hardware, software to infrastructure, Silicon Valley Bank works with companies across the innovation landscape at all stages of the journey, anticipating their needs before they do. And by providing access to insights and in-depth reports, SVB can help you make more informed decisions and assist in turning your great idea into a great business, which could be why 50% of US-based venture-backed tech and life science companies bank with SVB. Will your business be next? Learn more at svb.com/next. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.
And now, on with the show. From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. The people around you define your success, whatever that means for you. And they have the potential to change the course of your life. That is a line directly from this new book called You're Invited, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence by John Levy. And I think it's true. I think that every entrepreneur understands that that's true. We know that the network that we build is often our absolutely most important asset. But I think that people don't exactly know what to do with that information. Like, you know that the network is really important. You know that the people around you can define your success. But what are you supposed to do with that?
I actually really like this as a starting point, because what we are taught as we're like entering the job force or by mentors is always have to network.
This is John Levy, author of that book.
And I will be honest, I've met a lot of people. And I think just about all of us would agree that networking is just terrible. There was this awesome study done by Francesca Gino at Harvard Business School, and they looked at the unconscious association that we have to networking. And the way we feel about it is that we need to wash ourselves because we feel dirty.
Now, John Levy, this guy knows how to connect with people. I mean, he just does. I've seen it. I've been it. John is the founder of The Influencers, which he calls, quote, a private community and secret dining experience for industry leaders. And this is true. I have been, in fact, the episode that you might have just heard with Stacey London, where I described this party that I first met her at, that was John Levy's party. So John knows how to bring people together. And he says there is a better way than networking.
The first thing we need to realize is that forget networking. It's an awkward structure. It's antiquated. It doesn't make any sense. What we really want to do is make friends. And that means that the context has to change. The way we approach it needs to change. And especially the activities that we participate in need to change.
So, okay, how do we make those changes? How do we connect with people in a better way? That is what this episode is about. It is John Levy talking about how to really make connections. No networking required. It's coming up after the break. Have you ever been frustrated with traditional business networking groups like BNI? You know, too many restrictions, consuming all of your time, and even penalizing you for missing meetings? Well, now there is a better way. It is Network Lead Exchange. With Network Lead Exchange, you still have the exclusivity and the opportunity to build local business connections, but with more flexibility. It doesn't require in-person meetings. In fact, most of its meetings are virtual and can be attended on the go from your office or even a job site. And on top of that flexibility, Network Lead Exchange is powered by a feature that allows members to communicate and send referrals to each other. This ensures that the networking never stops. Network Lead Exchange is looking to expand its footprint through franchising. So if you or anyone you know might be interested in growing with them, visit networkleadexchange.com/podcast. Again, that is networkleadexchange.com/podcast. All right, we're back. So on this episode, again, we are talking to John Levy, author of the book, You're Invited. And just before the break, he had said that if we want to really connect with people, we got to put aside the idea of networking and think about making friends. And that means changing all these important things, the context in which you're meeting people, the approach, the activities that you do. And all of it is leading towards this idea, which is that ultimately what you're trying to do is build trust.
Because if they don't trust you, it doesn't matter if you're connected to them or not. And then in an ideal scenario, how do you give people a sense of belonging so that they feel connected to each other?
And I want a clarifying question as you continue to go. Are we ultimately talking about someone who is participating in an environment or creating that environment? Because you are a creator of environments. Not everyone will or can do that, but lots of people will participate in an environment, show up somewhere where it feels like they can meet other people. So I'm curious if you're directing people towards being a creator or a participant.
So the answer is both. And I think you make a really important distinction. And when you talk about me being a person who creates environment, it's not uncommon for me to host several hundred people or 100 people at a time for events. I don't recommend that for other people.
Right.
One of the, like,
it's a lot. First,
not only is it a lot, it's exhausting and you probably won't get what you're looking for out of it. I just really like bringing people together. So I kind of get a kick out of it. But even if you're incredibly introverted and are meeting a friend for coffee, in that moment, you're actually an environment creator.
That's a good way of thinking of it.
So if the moment that I invite you to some place or I suggest in a place for us to meet or an activity, I'm taking an active role in designing the experience. And we have the choice of if that's going to be a late night drink with somebody or after work drinks or an activity that actually has the potential to bond us. And here's a kind of simple example. Have you ever been to a business dinner? Like a company that's trying to pitch you for business takes you out for a really nice meal. Now, most of the time when I ask people about this, they say, oh my God, I'm stuck next to somebody. The conversation isn't necessarily good. I feel obligated to be there because they're paying for the meal. And they don't really rate the experience as super positive.
No, I stopped going. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent, if you want, assign it to the more junior people who it's still like exciting and novel for.
Uh-huh. Right. It's like, oh, free meal? Awesome. Yeah. But then you reach a certain age where you're like, I would rather just pay for my meal. So
yeah.
I don't have to sit
like
there.
Candyland with my kids, right?
That's right.
So now not the flip side of it, but the other activities we see are like parties with swag bags, and then we just throw out the swag bags. So these kinds of experiences don't actually connect us or build trust in any meaningful way. But oddly, the exact opposite does. And what I mean by that is there's this ridiculous quirk of human behavior called the IKEA effect. And it essentially states that we disproportionately care about our IKEA furniture because we had to assemble it. So
wow. That's interesting. I thought the IKEA effect was going to be that we go to great lengths for meatballs.
Oh my God. People love the IKEA meatballs. It's incredible. I mean, I think they come for the meatballs and they
stay for the furniture. So, okay. Anyway, sorry to derail you. That's a really interesting point. Because you put the work into it, even though it is generally cheap furniture, you feel more attached to it.
Precisely. You value it more. Not that you necessarily like it, but Jason, let's be honest. The reason you care about your children is that you invest effort into caring for them.
That's true. And that's why I don't care about other people's children.
Precisely. And that's why parents who adopt kids love their children just as much as if they were born to them, because they put in the effort. And so as a person who brings people together, whether that's one-on-one or large groups or whatever it is, I look for activities that will actually let people bond. So we had originally met, I believe, when you came to one of my dinners.
That's right.
So for the listeners, I've been for over a decade, been running a kind of private dining experience. And generally we have 12 people who come. They cannot talk about what they do or even give their last name. They cook dinner together. And when they sit down to eat, they get to guess what everybody does. And they find out that it's Jason and then 8-time Olympic medalist, a Nobel laureate, a CEO or entrepreneur, and so on and so forth. I've hosted over 2,000 people at 227 dinners.
Yeah. At the dinner that I was at, the person who didn't require any guessing, at least by me, was that Matt Pinfield, host of 120 Minutes. Is that what that show is called on MTV, which I grew up watching, was there. And it was like hilarious to try to act like I didn't know who Matt Pinfield was until dinner. But yes, okay, so good summary for the listener. So you are creating an environment, and then you've created a kind of structure for that environment where people can have fun and you really control it. I mean, it was like a timed experience.
Oh, yeah. So we do that for a few reasons. The first is you'll notice the IKEA effect. We have people put joint effort into something. And the reason is, one, is it'll get them to care more about each other. But number two, what's really important is that it turns out human beings don't actually bond well when you just put them in like an interview situation. We tend to bond really well when we have an activity as a social catalyst. So when I ask you, okay, can you go move a table? Suddenly, you can either stay quiet doing it, or the activity itself is a common ground for you to begin a conversation. And that's, if you really look, that's how we've generally made friends. It's, we get paired off in the third grade with some kid to do an assignment and we become friends. Or you get put on a project with a coworker and you become friends. And so at the dinner, one of the big things is that we do that. And then we also time lock it, right? We increase the pressure, because when there's increased pressure, there's this really kind of interesting things that happens. And I don't think we've ever talked about this because it's relatively new research. So most people think that trust precedes vulnerability, and that's actually not true. Yeah. So the way it tends to work is, let's say I'm working on something with you and I'm totally overwhelmed and I just go, Jason, I do not know how I'm going to get this done. In that moment, I've put myself in a vulnerable situation. I've sent out a vulnerability signal. Now, if you make fun of me or ignore me, trust will be reduced. But if instead you acknowledge it and throw out your own signal of vulnerability, so you say something like, John, me too, I've been there, what's going on? The moment you do that, we've both demonstrated that we can be vulnerable with each other and we're safe. And so by putting ourselves in a situation where we're time locked, where there's like a lot of pressure suddenly, and we have to accomplish something bigger than any one of us can do by ourselves, it causes us to create a lot of these vulnerability loops. You'll say, oh, quickly pass me the, and then I'll jump in and pass you something, and so on and so forth. And then suddenly trust is built faster and faster and faster.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So my point in all of this is that, sure, you can go for drinks, but that's not necessarily considered like a healthy activity anymore. Although, don't get me wrong, right now people can have probably earned their drinks being locked in their home.
I cannot wait. I'm going to grab the first person I see and buy them a beer. I cannot wait for it. But yes, it's true. There are other activities in the world.
So that means that, let's say I'm a employer, right? I have a team of, let's say, five people who work for me. Rather than just doing like a happy hour, maybe turn it into a game. Rather than having your sales calls just be, oh, I'm going to come and do a demo or something, or I'm going to take you out for dinner, maybe do a fitness class together, maybe take a walk. There's a lot of activities that you could do that will increase the rate that you bond and the desire for people to connect.
That's really interesting. And I wonder, John, what you're describing there works well if you are already in some way connected to somebody, or you have some reason to be in touch with them. And so I see how it's a really good alternative to, for example, the dreaded business dinner that we were talking about a minute ago.
Yeah.
But to think back to the very beginning of our conversation, when you're talking about how terrible networking events are functionally fishing, right? Yeah. They're fishing. I'm going to go to a place where there are possibly, hopefully, some good fish, people that I want to meet that mm-hmm. are going to be useful to me. I don't know them. I have no other way to contact them. We'll be in the same pond and we will bump into each other. Is there a way to take what you're describing here, which is a better way to connect because of all these reasons that you just described, and apply it to making a connection with somebody that you don't already know?
Yeah. So this is a great, one of the things that I really look at is, I have this book coming out, You're Invited. And I separate the book into a bunch of sections. One is how to connect. The other is what builds trust. And the other is kind of what creates belonging or community. The trust stuff is kind of what we've discussed. But this connection thing is really essentially saying, how do I get somebody's attention in a way that reflects well on me? I can easily get people's attention by embarrassing myself or doing something stupid. But what is it that actually gets people's attention? And when we started researching this and looking at it, we realized that depending on what level of status a person has, they're looking for different things in their life. So actually, you kind of pointed to this and, you know, at this point in your career, you don't need a steak dinner or whatever it is. A drug.
Right. What I needed a decade ago was just free booze. Mm-hmm. You have free booze? Then I'm there. Yeah.
that's probably why we met. You're like, a free meal and free booze.
Yeah.
And you know The meal was once described by somebody we know in common as, I was expecting a phenomenal meal and decent company. I got the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Like the food is just terrible.
The food is terrible. Yeah. Right. And then it's hilarious to eventually discover that you serve the same thing at every one of these.
Yeah. 225 of the 227 dinners, it's been the same meal.
It's the same thing. Right. Because why? I mean, it makes sense. At first you're like, what? And then you realize, yeah, well, why on earth would you put the work into changing the meal if you know that it works? Anyway, this is a side note, but yes, that is a funny point.
So the question became, what is it that people actually want to engage around at different stages in their career? So in the early stages of a career, what we're generally looking for, I would argue, is skills, opportunities, access, and resources.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So I call that the SOAR model, right? These are for people, let's call them community level influencers. They have the respect of their friends and their community. If at a larger scale, they have a following of a few thousand or a few hundred. I don't mean on social media. I mean like among their peer groups, right? You could be like a martial arts master or something like that. And if you can really provide and develop status for having skills, opportunities, access, and resources, right? Some people like to hold a meetup or something like that where people can walk away with those things, they'll come. Now, that doesn't mean they'll actually connect once they're there, because then you need an activity that actually causes people to bond. But if you can provide those things or have a reputation for having those things, people will want to connect with you. Now, the next level up, if you're a CEO, CMO of a company that's got funding, then you generally can hire around skills or resources that you need. It's not finding really that specific skill set that applies to everybody is generally not like that easy. So what I've generally found their social issue is, or social pressures are, that is that everybody wants something from them.
That's right.
So like, okay, you're the editor-in-chief of a very respected outlet. Everybody's either coming to you because being around you gives them social clout. They want, what is it? Your time, your expertise, your access, your money, right? Either contracts or donations or whatever it is.
Sure. Or the thing that I can provide them, which is coverage or something like that, right? That describes me to a T. And this is why I've become extremely guarded with the people that I engage with for this exact reason, because most people are coming to me because they want something.
And if that's the case, you're, to use a really geeky term, you've got your shields up, right? Like it's, and so when I saw this, I realized that if I want to get through to people, there's kind of three or four things that I need to really take into account, especially if I want to connect with people at that level. I'm not talking like the Oprahs and the Richard Bransons and like these aren't the global people. These are kind of the industry respected people. And the first thing I would say is I had to lead with generosity. And the reason I say that is that if everybody's after something, then having a context where you don't feel like I'm after anything really lowers people's guard.
That's right. It's a differentiator. I can speak from personal experience of what you're talking about. If somebody reaches out to me and they are not asking me for something, that is literally the rarest thing that will happen during my day.
Yep.
It's crazy, but I immediately pay attention to it because it's so rare.
Yeah. Now, here's what's interesting. As we mentioned earlier, generosity doesn't mean giving you a bunch of stuff, right? Like, I'm guessing brands are constantly throwing you tech or whatever and like all these things to review.
And I don't want that stuff. That actually, even though they're giving me that stuff, it still feels like they're asking me for something.
And let's also be honest, when you reach this level in your career, you don't need more plastic items with batteries to sit in your house.
Like,
I don't want more stuff. If I wanted that stuff, I would buy it.
That's right.
But I didn't buy it.
It becomes burdensome. My wife despises it. She hates all this random crap that keeps showing up.
So the question then is, what do I actually mean by generosity? Now, I lean towards generosity of experience, but some people could lean towards generosity of knowledge, or there are different things you can be generous with. The key, though, is that whatever it is, I encourage you insert that IKEA effect. So like, I'm giving you an opportunity to invest effort into something. Now, that could be cooking dinner. It could be taking a hike. It could be, hey, I'm running this fitness group with industry leaders, and it's completely free. We're just going to go hiking every Saturday. Here's an open invitation. You can come. You don't, like, if you can't make it, no stress. So automatically we see it's generous and I'm not after anything. The second characteristic is novelty. And I think you'll very much associate with this. I do not want another invitation to a casino-themed fundraiser. Like, I'm happy to give money.
Sure.
Right? I just don't want to do that.
There.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that is so cookie cutter and boring. I've done it 5 or 6 times. I get that some people like to play poker, more power to them. But that has nothing to do with me enjoying myself. And especially with the nonprofit stuff, it kills me because it'll be like $500 a plate for a meal to stamp out hunger. It's just like the antithesis of the company's values is that they're shelling out hundreds of dollars to pay for these plates. But anyway, which means that there's a section of the brain called the SNVTA. It's essentially the major novelty center. And it responds relative to how novel something is. And that it entices us to explore and understand things. Translation, when something is novel, people are interested. The more novel it is, the more interested they are. So when I designed the dinner, I designed it to be very different from anything else. There are these strange rules that you don't know who's going to be there. There's a format that's different. And so if you do a hike or whatever it is that's going to be like your thing, the key is to make it original, right? You don't want to be a copycat. If you've noticed, nobody's ever been able to reproduce the success of TED. And that's because they originated a format and nobody's going to do it as well as they will. Now, if you create a different format, you can have there for a while. There was this RSA animation. Do you remember this?
No,
it was like people animating in real time talks. It was great. And it's the only talks I've ever seen get to the TED level in terms of millions of views. But it was like animations done to the talk. It was great. So in terms of novelty, the question is, what personal spin can you throw on it? And I can give you a few kind of like fun examples if you want.
Yeah, sure. I mean, rattle some off.
So there's a woman in LA who decided to invite people over to paint with her. And what she did was she took 25 small canvases, laid it out 5x5, drew one picture across all of them, and then handed it out to people to fill in whatever colors they wanted. And then when they come together, it all produces a single painting. So there you are sitting next to somebody painting. You have a natural conversation flowing. You have a shared activity, a shared
interest. By the way, sorry, I'm just going to interrupt to tell you, the listener, right now, no, the police are not coming for you. They are just going by John's apartment because he lives.
Oh, wow. You can hear that.
Oh, yeah. That's loud.
Oh, wow. Okay. Do you want to pause for a second?
No, it's fine. It's fine. I just wanted to acknowledge it because I know sometimes I've listened to podcasts and I'm like, well, and then I realize it's coming.
Then you realize that you're not in trouble.
So, okay. Just acknowledging. Okay. Keep
Maybe
going.
Somebody's doxing me and like they're the SWAT's right. Going to show up.
Right. SWAT. Hopefully they're doxing the pizza. The pizza is better than the SWAT.
So that takes a really simple activity and then makes it significantly more novel. Right. And when I went, there were like these celebrities from different shows there and random people that she would just invite people time after time. And it spread through the culture. And after a while, it really developed a community that loved it. And so you can take literally anything. I remember I was once in an office and somebody said, what can I do? And I said, what do you enjoy? He goes, I like running and donuts. I was like, oh, that one's easy. Do a donut run club. Start and end at a donut shop. Have the run be any length you want. And when you finish, have the people who didn't necessarily want to run join everybody for coffee and donuts and have like great conversations.
That sounds brilliant. If I liked to run, I would join that. I like
exactly. And that's what's important is that you have to do like, listen, you're not going to appeal to everybody. Mm-hmm. Right? My event doesn't appeal to everybody. But what's important is that it gets enough of the type of people that you're interested in meeting to come. You're not going to boil the ocean and meet every person.
Okay, I'm interrupting here because we have to take a brief word from our sponsor. But when we come back, we're going to dig a level deeper with John. Because, you know, the thing is, his book, it's titled You're Invited. And the subtitle is The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. And the word influence can feel kind of yucky, you know, like you're sneakily trying to get people to do what you want them to do. Or it means influencer, which doesn't mean anything. And I wanted to contrast that with this very human connection focused philosophy that John has. How are you supposed to be cultivating influence along with actual relationships? His answer is really interesting. We will get into it right after the break. If you're an e-commerce seller and you're doing 7 or 8 figures of revenue on your site and you are not doing conversion optimization, you are leaving tons of cash on the table. Running marketing experiments is key to optimizing conversions, but chances are you aren't doing enough. That's why you need Conversion Fanatics. They run thousands of marketing experiments every year for huge clients like Clorox, Burt's Bees, ClickFunnels, and many more. Conversion Fanatics optimizes your site for you so you can get a lot more customers, scale up your traffic faster, and see a lot more profit fall to your bottom line. After optimizing hundreds of sites, Conversion Fanatics has an extensive test vault of proven winners to draw from, and it's run, owned, and operated by guys who have built their own 7 to 8 figure brands for years before ever doing it for anyone else. They tackle the nitty-gritty user research for you, plus everything from idea to UX design and development to execution. They can test anything. So what are you waiting for? Go to conversionfanatics.com today for a free proposal and tell them Problem Solvers sent you. They'll analyze your site, throw in conversion boosting ideas for free. That is conversionfanatics.com. All right, we're back talking to John Levy about connecting with people in a non-networky way. And this second half of the conversation, we're going to start by talking about influence. I will warn you, then John and I veer off into a rather academic conversation about how we may or may not be living in a different world of connection than before. You can decide who you agree with. But then we bring it back around to how having these kinds of disagreements are actually part of building connection. Anyway, let's get to the idea of influence. Subtitle of your book, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. I want to pull that word influence out for the final phase of our conversation here, because we've been talking about connecting with people, either building stronger connections with people that you're connected with in some way, but you're looking to develop that relationship further, or actually finding some means by which to make real connections with people that you don't know instead of just handing them a business card that they're going to throw out.
Yeah.
Is that influence? What do you mean by influence?
I think it's kind of funny because influence seems like a very cold word.
Yes. Right?
It seems like an almost opportunistic word. But our influence is really our ability to impact a person or an outcome. And I've spent my adult life looking at how to bring people together and develop deep and meaningful relationships. And when we really look at it, our influence is a byproduct of who we're connected to. Because if we're not connected to somebody, we're not going to be able to influence them. How much they trust us, because if we're not trustworthy, then we're not going to have any real influence on them. And the sense of belonging that we share, meaning that if the two of us are part of the same community or communities, then we're going to have a tighter knit relationship. And that in itself will cause us to affect each other more. And so when I say influence, it seems like a very technical idea, but it comes down to the fact that we each have a really profound impact on each other. And it's bigger than most people realize. There was a study done in the 2000s by Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, and they were curious about the obesity epidemic. Does it spread from person to person like a cold? Is it that kind of epidemic? Or is it a percentage of the population, like Alzheimer's? And what they found was startling. If you have a friend who's obese, your probability of obesity increases 45%. Your friends who don't know them, they do not know them, have a 20% increased chance, and their friends have a 5% increased chance. And this kind of effect exists for happiness, smoking, marriage and divorce rates, voting habits. It turns out that just about everything flows through our social networks, our communities. And so when we look at influence, I'm looking at it from the perspective of, okay, I want to have healthy business habits, right? I want to learn to save better. Maybe I should meet people who are really good at business. And as a byproduct, that'll permeate the conversations that surround me and what my priorities are, and I'll get better at it. And similarly with fitness or with just about anything. So the issue is, and this is kind of wild, in 1985, the average American had 3 friends besides family. So 1985, 3 friends besides family. By 2004, that was down to 2. Now that's crazy. In less than a generation, we lost an entire friend or 50% of our friends. And much of that has to do with the fact that people are moving further away from home for their career and school and so on. And that also means that people are lonelier and more disconnected. And if you look, that means that we've limited our ability to influence our lives, because it's limited the number of people in our in our the circles around us. And so I'm a strong believer that right now it's really important that we make the effort to connect with new people and find common ground and do activities and really find a way to give people belonging.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly second that. Although interestingly, I'm curious if you've come across this. Just I was talking about that exact kind of research, how over time our social network size has changed, with the director of internet research at the Pew Research Center. I could have some of those words wrong, but anyway. Hi, I'm just going to interrupt myself to say who I am talking about is Lee Rainey, the director of internet and technology research at the Pew Research Center. I spoke with him for my other podcast, Build for Tomorrow, which is an exploration of how change happens and digs into a lot of the stuff that John and I are now talking about. Okay, anyway, back to me. And he made this very interesting point because there have been some alarming studies that are like that. And so they went to dig into it and try to reproduce it. And what they found was that a lot of that data was actually not coming out of the true size and shape of people's networks, but instead how the researchers were asking the questions. Because sure. Researchers were asking questions based on a decades-old understanding of what a network looked like. Because now, unlike decades ago, our network was pretty straightforward. The people that we were closest with were largely people who lived near us and who we saw with some frequency. And what the Pew guy had hypothesized or had found in their own research is that the size of our networks haven't necessarily changed, but the way that we utilize them has. So because we have access to the internet, and because we are connected now to people that we don't know, but also that we do know, but maybe 20 years ago wouldn't have been able to keep up with, we have a more distributed network. And instead of finding people that we need for every part of our social needs, we instead distribute our social needs across lots of different people. So for example, I might have the person that I turn to for career advice and the person that I turn to for joking throughout the day and the person that I turn to for this thing or that thing. And these can be different people and they fulfill some parts of our lives. But if you ask a question based on a 1980s understanding of what your network looks like, then it's not going to pick up this new, more nuanced understanding of what a network is. Now, is the more modern network better or worse than the previous network? He didn't have an answer to that. And I don't love those kinds of questions because I think that different isn't necessarily better or worse. It's just different. But anyway, I bring that up as an interesting, not necessarily counter argument, because I still think that your point is really, really valid, that we should always be looking for how to expand our network and create close ties because we benefit from those relationships and other people benefit from the relationships with us. But I will caution, you're welcome to push back if you want to, but I will caution against saying, oh, in the dawn of the internet age, our networks have changed and we bemoan the time, right? Because it's just more, the reality is more nuanced than that.
There's no doubt, right? So there's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yes.
And for the listeners, since you know what this is, in general, the less we know about something, the more confident we are. And the more we know about something, the less we are confident because we understand that there's complexities and nuances. So there's no doubt.
Another way of saying the Dunning-Kruger effect, because you gave the more academic version. The other way is that dumb people don't realize they're dumb.
Yes. I just wanted to be polite because there's... I don't know who's listening, but I guess you don't know you're dumb anyway. So that's not weird about that.
Right. It doesn't apply to you.
Yeah. So there's a few things I'd push back around.
Sure.
Right. I think that there's accuracy to that there's now like, oh, you have your tech expert friend, so you'll go to them about which phone to buy and all that kind of stuff. But when we look at the same question asked across generations, we still see that there's a shift towards loneliness the younger a person is. So even though you'd expect the boomers to be lonelier because maybe their friends are passing and so on and so forth, it's actually, they probably have a higher sense of belonging than the Gen Zers, which feel like they're not understood and so on. Now, you could argue that potentially that's purely a generational thing. And as you get older, that might be the case.
You could also argue that what our definition of lonely is changes across time. There's a fascinating book called Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid by these two academics that I've interviewed.
I know which two I am.
Anyway, what's really interesting is what they do is they go through the history of how we express those emotions. And they find that what we mean by bored or lonely or angry or stupid, it actually changes by generation. And so it's hard to really understand what one generation means relative to another generation. But anyway, sorry. I always push back against this generation is vastly different than previous generations. This is my bugaboo, but I welcome you to push back against my pushback.
So I think the issue here is that there's a few trends that we're seeing, regardless of like, oh, this every generation believes that the following generation is lazy.
Every time. You could track that back to Roman times.
Yeah. It's just like how, what was it? Socrates was worried about this new invention called writing or whatever it was that's going to ruin our memories. Every time like a new technology comes out, oh my God, it's going to ruin society.
Right. I could actually give you like a 5-minute dissertation on that exact thing. It was Socrates as a character in Plato's Phaedrus. I don't know, whatever. So philosophy major will kill me for that. But anyway, yes, the concern for those curious is that Socrates was saying that now that we can read, we will not have our memory. Though he actually was using memory in a kind of abstract term. What he was saying was that it's the difference between reading something and knowing it by experience, which is true.
Oh, interesting. You know, yeah. So I completely agree. What we can kind of track is a few things like anti-fragility. So there's the idea that if I drop a glass, it'll shatter. It's fragile. But on the other end of the spectrum, there are things that actually get stronger when you apply pressure to them. So our muscles when we lift weights. And it used to be the case that certain states like get into first grade or something like that. The questionnaires would say, can your child go and buy milk by themselves. Now, the idea of having a first grader now do that is completely insane. But as a byproduct, even though it's safer than ever, just about COVID aside, more and more protective of our kids. And as a byproduct, they're less and less developed in social skills. So I can absolutely agree that like there's stereotypes that are about ages.
Yeah.
And then there's that will always be there, right? Like, or maybe not, but whatever.
Yeah, probably always. Thousands of years of history thus far have helped.
That's suggested. Yeah. Right? And they're going to be fine. Like eventually, like it works out. And then there's kind of trends that always exist, right? Like we talk about those who survived the Great Depression have a collection of characteristics that are kind of different than the generation before them and the generation after.
Sure.
Those that grew up in the 1950s where America was producing 2/3 of the world's product have different characteristics. So all of this is to say in a kind of semi-simplified view of the world that regardless of the source or if it's as big of an issue or not as we think it is, we've been able to see from other research that the greatest predictor of human longevity is not exercise or clean air and things like that, but rather number two is strong social ties and number one is social integration, like you're part of something. And similarly, research by Paul J. Zak found that you can correlate company stock value, employee sick days, and what was the other one? Profitability to oxytocin levels in employee bloodstream, which means that the greater the sense of belonging they have, clearly the less they're like calling out sick, searching for another job. And so regardless of what the level of isolation that people feel or not, it does have a pretty serious impact on people when they do. And to the point that loneliness is on par with smoking about a pack a day of cigarettes in terms of health impact. And if that's the case, then it seems that a lot of the issues that we might be dealing with can be solved by figuring out how to connect better. And that's what I care about.
Yeah, I love that. And thanks for indulging me on this long research volley. So
can I just say how much I love that you actually did that? Because just like our muscles are anti-fragile, ideas are anti-fragile. And unless people push back on them, we're not going to get any new insights. If we just agreed with each other on everything, then we would miss a lot of things. And now maybe I should go back and look at the research.
That's a wonderful and generous point. And you're totally right. I mean, this is the, you know, there's that old saying, the marketplace of ideas, right? You know, ideas become strengthened as they get challenged. And I love, just to kind of bring it back as a final thing, I had asked you, however many minutes ago, about your definition of the word influence there. And I liked how you landed it on this spectrum of how the word influence is used. When I think of the word influence, I often think of like two things, either influencer, which is a meaningless term at this point, right? So kind of frivolous, space filler word. And on the other end, how to win friends and influence people, which feels sort of underhanded in a way, even though I don't know if that's what the intention of that book was, but that's how it feels.
I hear the language changes from generation to generation. So who knows?
Yeah, that's right. Touche. But what you're doing is you're landing it in a different place, right? You're thinking of influence as the importance of a network, that the more that we are connected to each other, the more that we influence each other in what can be positive and not underhanded or even scheming kind of ways, but really just rather that we are all better when we are influencing each other, which very much goes to the way that you just put into context the conversation that we just had, that, you know, we influence each other by presenting ideas and seeing how they land. And that is a valuable and nice way, I think, of framing the word influencer. Not influencer, but influence.
So there's a litmus test that I write about in the book. Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, my background's in behavioral science. I know a lot of these techniques and methodologies to understand kind of like where the brain kind of acts funny, like this IKEA effect stuff. And one of the things that became my policy is that if anybody asks why something is designed the way that it is, I have to tell them full out. Not like corporate secrets and stuff like that, but I tell people like, oh, we have you cook together so you'll like each other more because of the IKEA effect. And the reason is that if I can do that for a stranger, then I know I don't have to risk ever being manipulative because they'll call me out on it right away if I did. No, the reason is that I want you to start smoking cigarettes, right? Like if I'm willing to be honest like that, then people would quickly find out that I have non-benevolent reasons and then it would be the end of my reputation. So that's my general litmus test is like if I'm willing to answer the why things are designed the way they are.
Well, John, I'm glad that this podcast is not the end of your reputation.
Me too. That'd be super awkward. And probably an amazing episode for you guys.
That's true. Maybe I should have tried to end your reputation just for the clicks. John Levy, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
This has been an absolute pleasure.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.